When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the No Bad Dogs podcast with me, Tom Davis, America's canine educator. Today, we have Pete Paxton, and this is going to be a great podcast for any dog person, dog lover, dog owner, dog trainer, anything. What I'm trying to do on the podcast is trying to be as universal as possible. Listen, I'm a person who loves dogs, loves learning about dogs, which has led me to the career I'm in and educating and training. And the more I dive into the industry, the more opportunities I get to work with people from all over the industry. So on the show today, we have Pete Paxton. Pete Paxton is an investigator that goes in and investigates puppy mills, collects enough data and information to prosecute these puppy mills to a point of them being shut down and never existing and opening again. And some of these puppy mills have a ton of puppies. I mean, we're talking thousands of dogs, and you know, it's sad. I mean, listening to this podcast, and trust me, guys, I'm the type of person that if I see anything related to dog abuse or anything talking about that sort of thing, I shy away. I don't listen to it. I don't talk to it. This is not going to get into that much detail about the specifics, but it really is eye-opening and disheartening to know that these things are happening. But the beauty of this podcast is knowing that there's people like Pete that are out there in the field working day and night to getting these places shut down. So I really, really enjoyed talking to Pete, and I hope you guys enjoy this podcast. And just so you guys know, this podcast today is brought to you by my friends over at Dogtra. Dogtra.com, you can find all of my favorite remote collar training collars to purchase for any type of remote or off-leash training that you want with your dog. And tell people a little bit about what you do and some of the things you've been doing in the dog industry.
Sure. So my name is Pete Paxton. I do investigative work for animal protection groups. About half of my work since 2001 has been investigating puppy mills and pet stores. It's primarily undercover work. So I have worked at some facilities undercover as an employee, and at others, I just kind of will go in and document the facility by walking on or using surveillance. And point of all this is to try to uncover the conditions that the animals that we use as pets, you know, where they come from. So a great specific example of what I do is one of my biggest clients is CAPS, the Companion Animal Protection Society.
Okay.
And I'll go to pet stores, and I will, you know, filming undercover, I will, I'll ask them, you know, where do your puppies come from? Do you know about the conditions of the breeders? And they'll tell me if they visit them, and they'll often say that the puppies are running around in open yards and so forth. And then I will go to the actual facilities that breed the puppies and then document those conditions, report any violations to the USDA or law enforcement. And then we will take all of that footage and then make it public for people to see. So that's essentially what my job is. The rest of my job has been doing undercover work on factory farms, slaughterhouses, commercial fishing boats. And the only reason I'd mention that is, you know, perhaps as the interview goes on, some of the things that I can explain about what happens with dogs that are in breeding, you know, some of the cruelty that goes on. I don't have to be too graphic for your listeners, but people always want to ask, why people would treat dogs like that. And it the similarities between how dogs are treated in puppy mills, the reasons for it and the kind of neglect and cruelty that occurs is identical to how livestock such as hogs and chickens are treated. And those are the kinds of things that we outline in my book, Rescue Dogs.
Hmm. And this is all in the United States, right?
All of my dog work has been in the U.S. I have investigated the dog meat trade in the Philippines. Mm. But besides that, it's all been in the U.S.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So I want to take a step back a little bit and talk about like the process. So when you said that you report to CAPS, now is CAPS a representation of who are they representing in this?
Oh, sure. So CAPS is they're a nonprofit. I have a variety of clients. They're all non-government organizations. Humane Society, United States, CAPS. CAPS is my biggest client by far for puppy mills.
And do they hire you to go in and do this work? Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's what they'll do. So I can, you know, for listeners who maybe have, you know, don't know a whole lot about this and are wondering, you know, who are these crazy animal rights people that are, you know, filming things. Yeah, I can give you the real quick version of it is that we have things that we'll call, there's like selected targets and there's random targets. And CAPS likes to focus pretty heavily on selected targets now. And what that means is for example, I'll go into a pet store. Like right now, the hot issue is trying to pass a bill in New York to ban stores from selling puppies from breeders, right? And so I had visited well over 70 pet stores in New York. And then when I got information about where the conditions that they claimed their breeders had the puppies in, I knew exactly who the breeders were that I was going to, the breeders that were supplying them. And then I documented them. Or another example would be, we had a complaint about a puppy miller a while ago in Minnesota. We had a very specific complaint that she was committing animal cruelty and doing her own surgeries on her own dogs. So I had to go undercover as an employee and get hired into her facility. Now, what I used to do way back in the day is just what we called random targets, which is that any puppy mill anywhere, right? Just go find out what's going on at puppy mills. Right? Mm-hmm. If it's in this state, let's just expose it. If it's one of a thousand places that are selling to this chain of stores, just go get into them. And the terrible reality, which we really try to outline in the book to explain the nuts and bolts of why, the terrible reality is that you don't have to look too far or look too hard to start finding violations.
Yeah. So I want to lay it out for listeners who are unfamiliar with the process of the puppy mill and buying puppies in stores, big box stores, and et cetera. So basically the process works like this, and correct me if I'm wrong, is puppy mills will breed a specific breed of puppy, and then they will then sell and distribute those puppies to bigger stores like malls and places that are going to be selling these puppies. Is that correct?
That's correct. The big thing now is that they're also selling them online.
So they're selling them directly, or they're selling them to the store, and then the stores, I guess, at what do the mills just produce the dogs and they don't have anything to do with distribution to individual owners? They only distribute to commercial, let's say, businesses.
Well, it could be either or. So for example, most puppy millers prefer to do, most commercial breeders, is they prefer to sell to a broker. So let's just say that if you want to sell sight unseen, that means you are not actually meeting the person who's buying your puppy. Then you have to have a USDA license, right? If you're selling for resale, you have to have a USDA license. If you're selling right out the door, you don't have to have a USDA license. But those people are going to have what's called a Class A license. Class A generally means you're breeding your dogs. Now, if you have a Class B license, that means you're a broker. That means that you buy puppies and then you resell them. So, you know, there's different examples of that. One of the biggest ones is called Choice Puppies in Goodman, Missouri. I worked undercover at their facility years ago, and they would have, you know, 3,000 puppies at a time. They'd come from all over the country, and then they would sell puppies all over the world.
3,000.
Right? Oh, yeah, 3,000. And about a third were sick at any given time. Because, you know, puppies, when they're young, they're very suppressed immune systems, and they've been through a lot. Yeah. But another example of a Class B dealer would be a facility I worked at that was getting dogs, and some of which people bred, some of which were stolen pets. Oh. And then they would sell them to research labs. And that's in a they made a documentary about the case called Dealing Dogs. But the only similarity there, the only reason that I'd mention it, is that all of these facilities, they're Class A, they're Class B, they're licensed by the federal government. So they're inspected by a federal inspector.
Right.
Right. Many other facilities, which, you know, you may or may not call a puppy mill, maybe they're selling out the door or not. Maybe they have a few dogs or a lot of dogs. They may or may not be state licensed, depending on the state. And so, you know, that's essentially, without getting into the too much of the details of the evidence, that's essentially how it works. Is you have people that some will sell out the door, but most it's online and it's to a store, because the term puppy mill is common. Everybody knows what it means. Nobody wants to be called it. So nobody wants someone coming out to their property to look at their dogs.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That's so you mentioned, Pete, that the people are in the United, it's as a professional, right? It's really disturbing to know that. And I know that this type of stuff is going on, but not to the extent of what you're telling us and what you're going to continue to tell us, which is interesting. And I think that education is the most important thing moving forward with any of this stuff. It's just like when the, for an example, you know, I'm not, when the documentary started coming out about factory farming, I'll be brutally honest. I mean, I'm not a vegan. I eat meat, but I had no idea that type of stuff was, I mean, I did, you know, I was thinking the McDonald's, the, you know, the really, really big multi-billion-dollar organizations were the only people that were really doing this type of stuff. I didn't realize it was local, quote unquote, butcher shops and supermarkets and things like that. I just didn't know. And honestly, it changed the way that I purchased meat on all levels, not just fish as well, chicken, everything that I learned from, and it was obviously those types of things are really hard to watch. But by any means, it was just one of those things that the education of just exposing this type of stuff to just tell people that this is what's happening and the way that you get your meat, regardless of if you eat meat or you don't, in the way that you want it to be packaged and produced and all that stuff, whatever, is really important to know just how it gets to your plate and how the animals are treated.
Yeah. And you're 1,000% right.
And going through this process of kind of just, and here we are in 2020. And as you know, I mean, the dog industry just alone, just with items and services, and it's becoming very, 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 it's becoming more of a thing. It's becoming very bougie, if you will. People are hiring people to do stuff with their dogs that you never thought would happen.
Right.
And yet there's still this undercover, not exposed thing or things that is happening in the industry that people are so blind to, including myself, which is why, you know, I got this email. I was like, wow, you know, I want to learn more about this so I can be more, you know, I can educate other people. And so what you've done as a little recap here for the listeners, because that's a lot of information.
Right.
So
right.
What you've done, and we'll get into more specifics, is you're basically going undercover as you're going to a job interview as a potential employee to say, hey, I'd love to work at this disgusting puppy mill or whatever.
Right.
And you get hired on, and then how long would you be, I mean, tell me that process. How would you go through that process of getting hired in the interview and lying basically and getting on the job? That's interesting.
Sure. Sure. So not all of them are employment-based cases, but for an employment-based case, when I started back in 2001, you know, my first My first three cases lasted 6 months each. But it was for specific reasons. I was going after two of those facilities. I was going after felony fraud. You know, there was a lot of animal cruelty, but I was going after, I was going after something where, you know, vets were signing forms for dogs to cross state lines and they weren't examining the dogs. And I had to get access to those forms. Right. It was very specific. You know? Whereas, you know, my other cases, you know, once I started doing a lot more, you know, once I really got into the groove of employment-based cases, it turned into 6 weeks. And then once, and I can kind of, I can explain this, you know, if you'd like, but once I knew the type of facility I'm at and what kind of predictable criminal activity I'm looking for, 2 to 3 weeks, my last few cases that were employment-based were just 2 weeks, you know, that's it. And, you know what you're looking for, you know how to find it, how to document it. Yeah. And, you know, when it comes to when it comes to, you know, the rest of the puppy mill stuff, a lot of it is what we call walk-ons, where I would just convince someone to allow me access to their puppy mill so that I can just get in, show what's going on, and then I'd leave. Because many puppy mills are very small. You know, it's a husband and wife who run the facility, and you know, they may not have a lot of employees. And then the other type of work would just be surveillance, just whatever it takes to get eyes on it. So that if a store says these dogs are not in cages, these dogs are running in grassy yards, look at this video of dogs in yards. That's how they all are. You just need a camera on the suppliers to show, look, it's dogs that are spinning in cages. Right. You know, and I should say before we get too much into it, I should say to your listeners real quick, regardless of whatever I'm about to say, no matter how crazy or unbelievable it sounds, you don't have to take my word for any of this. Everything that I have to say is there's video and audio documentation that's online for it.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. So, all right. So that's a whole can of worms there. That's just like, it's really, it's really blowing my mind right now. I'm trying to wrap my head around, and I get it. Like I understand anything mass produced and anything sold, like if you can get your dog food from the local, you know, gas station, it's probably not good. Mm-hmm. And same thing, if you go to the mall to pick up a freaking dress or, you know, a ball cap or something, you're like, hey, let's get a dog too. I mean, obviously to me and all the other professional dog people listening to this and the dog owners, you're like, yeah. And again, we talk about ignorance and not knowing, like if you've bought a dog from a place such as what we're talking about, and if you don't know the things that they've been going through, at this point, you know, it is what it is, like ignorance is bliss. But moving forward from that, you know, my objective is always to educate myself and other people about the things that are going on in the dog world. And of course, your passion and drive is to expose these disgusting living environments for puppies and dogs and tell people like, hey, this is going on in your backyard and you don't even realize it. So go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, for me, it's like, I knew that the puppy, you know, I can't even go into there. Like I can't even walk into one of those stores. As much as I love dogs, like it just pisses me off where I'm like, these dogs are sitting in metal crates. Their bones, they're 8 weeks to 12 week old dogs that their bones are still developing. And they're literally laying on silver, metal crate pans, like some sort of like fried chicken, just waiting for somebody to come pick it up. And that alone is like, what are you doing? They're animals. They're not, in the way that they expose them, it's like a different world. They're in like these little boxes for you to view. And it's very commercial. And so I knew that it was wrong and I knew that it's bad. And I understand that, but I'm really excited to dive into this a little bit deeper with you to just go over the stuff that you really don't get to see. And that's very, like, it's just really exposing, which is good. I'm really glad that you're doing that. Well, thank you, because I was a dog lover way before I started working with dogs. I'm sure you were too, before you started really getting into this stuff. And if somebody doesn't do that stuff, then who will, you know, who's going to actually, you know, so you said in your first email when we corresponded with each other that, you've shut down successfully. You've been able with your work and your investigation, you've been able to actually shut big puppy mills down as well.
Yes.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's tough. It's it takes a lot. There's a lot that goes into the kind of stuff that happens that's so terrible to dogs. There's a lot that goes into what it takes to overcome them. And I can, I can explain it, but I'd want to tell your listeners real quick, if you have a puppy from a breeder, I'm not trying to make you feel bad. I'm sure you love right. your puppy. Please have an open mind. And again, don't take my word for anything I'm about to say. You can, do your own research to verify this. The reason that I do what I do and the reason that I document things the way I do is to prove it. Right. Mm-hmm. Not to make you guess, but to prove it. And the reason I've been to well over 700 puppy mills is to show it's not an isolated incident. If right. Any of your listeners, if you're a breeder and if you're like, hey, I'm not a puppy mill, I breed my dog once a year. I'm not trying to make you feel bad. You may not agree with everything I have to say, but if we all love dogs, let's all just be open minded and take whatever good information we can. Yeah. Basically the idea is that, there's a lot of dogs that are euthanized in this country. It's like, it's not quite almost 700,000 now in shelters that are euthanized, and you have about 2 million, dogs that are bought as pets. Right. And so it would seem on the surface level, it would seem like you have just over like 1.3 million that we could still breed and we could still buy as pets, and you still might not be killing dogs, but it's a little elusive. That information is a little, what we're looking for to save dogs is a little elusive there, because you still have about 860,000 cats that are euthanized in shelters. So they need homes, right? So you still have this leftover amount. And it's like, well, maybe we still have about 500,000 that we could get. But the problem is that there's an enormous amount of dogs that need help increasingly in areas like Puerto Rico and the Caribbeans, where hurricanes are coming and they're just wiping out people's homes. Mm-hmm. And it falls upon rescues to get the dogs and get them over here. And I've done a lot of factory farm slaughter work in Mexico and India, and especially in Mexico, because it's right across the border. The situation with dogs there is terrible. We need to be spending efforts to try and save them and to help them out. And right now you have any of your listeners who are part of a rescue community knows that dogs cross state lines regularly because there's no space, mm-hmm. Perhaps in your local shelter or even your local state to save a dog who needs help, and you got to get that dog to another state. Well, sometimes you got to get out of the country, so yeah. For those reasons, really trying to promote rescue and what we look for if I was to go to a breeder, what I'm looking for is if they have a USDA license. I'm looking for violations of the Animal Welfare Act. The facility has to be clean. The dogs have to have a certain amount of space. But the problem is that in the Federal Animal Welfare Act, if you can read it online and you'll read about every little thing, they can't have rust, they can't have mold, all this. There is nothing in the entire federal act that has anything to do with a dog's psychological well-being at a breeding facility. So, on a lot of the undercover footage, like if you go to caps-web.org, you see a lot of my footage on there and other investigators' footage. On the undercover footage, we're kind of walking through and you see dogs running and spinning in cages. But in the surveillance footage, where the camera's just sitting there for over a minute and it's just steadily watching, that's when you see dogs that are spinning in cages absolutely nonstop and they won't quit. And when you get those dogs out of puppy mills and you put them on the ground, they don't know what to do. A lot of them will just walk in a circle because that's all they've known how to do, right? Now, if it's a federally licensed facility or it's unlicensed, I'm still going to be looking for violations of the state cruelty statute. And most states, what that's going to mean is if an animal is having to go any kind of unnecessary suffering. So if the animal is in need of veterinary care but it's not being provided, if they're injured or sick, or if someone's beating or abusing the animal. Mm. Now, for abuse, that is where you're really going to find out if you do an employment-based case and you work somewhere. And when you work undercover at a facility, the truth is always stranger than fiction. So I can give you kind of two very different examples to kind of explain. In one of the chapters of of the book Rescue Dogs. It's called Maggie, and it's about this huge puppy mill I worked at. I worked undercover there for about 6 weeks, and it was the target where we had a complaint. She was doing illegal surgeries on her own dog. She'd already been busted for it. And
what type of surgeries? Like, what do you mean?
C-sections, spays, neuters, okay. Ear croppings, tail. Yeah. When I went there, she was getting busted for it. Right. And so I go there, you know, she sweats me down because she's already, law enforcement's already onto her. And while I'm there at the facility, there's animals that are, they're being neglected to death. They have pretty severe medical conditions and eye infections, and they're vomiting blood, and they're just kind of left to die. And then eventually when there'd be too many, they'd take them off and they'd shoot them. Right.
Jesus.
It was a pretty bad place. And
sorry to interrupt. I couldn't, and I'm just giving you my feedback, and I'm sure some of my listeners are, you know, probably like, wow, you know, cause like for me, you know, in the training industry, like I get it. Like these dogs could either die or get euthanized or whatever, if I don't help with the problems, whatever. But
yeah.
Like, I can't even walk into like one of those pet stores without becoming like nauseous and sick to my stomach, because I just want to help. That's why it's hard for me to go into a shelter, because of what I do for a living and the behavioral cases that I take on. I'm just like, all of this work is in front of me and I can help. And so, and I know that the macro is you helping, right? How hard is it for you to go through 6 weeks of watching this happen? Obviously you like dogs. But how hard is that for you? You know, what's going through your mind when you're watching this happen, when you know you could probably maybe help some of these dogs immediately? How hard is it for you to just turn the other way and just think of the bigger picture?
You know, that's a good question. The way that I always put it to everybody is that I'm 49% driven by a love of animals and wanting to help animals, but I'm 51% driven by a love of investigations. I love undercover work.
Yeah.
And so
I can tell. Yeah.
You know, I know this might sound kind of crazy, or this might sound a little strange, but you know, when it even in an animal cruelty case, if someone says, "Hey, we got an animal cruelty case," you know, and you know, there's this terrible thing happening, and we don't know how to get it. That sounds like fun. Like, I want to get it. I want to get in. I want to nail it. You know, and so I hate it when I see terrible things, and I hate it when there's, I'll be at a facility, and there's an animal that I know is suffering,
right,
and I got to go home, and I got to log the footage, do the notes, and try to sleep, and that animal's just there not being helped. I mean, it's terrible, but you know, I love building a case. When it's been really hard is, I think was my first case, probably because it was my first case and because it was dogs, and because some of those dogs were stolen pets and they were being sold to research labs. Oof. That's when it was really tough, because it was just,
I can't even like put into words what that makes me feel like. You know, there's so much emotion, even just hearing that, you know, just hearing somebody's animal and pet being stolen, and then, you know, the family's out doing the post, because that's what goes through my head. I have a very, what people have told me is like, I have empath, which believe in whatever you want to believe, but it's like my ability to feel feelings of like other animals and other people on a very small level of like, when you say that, I immediately go into a family, gloves and mittens out, stapling up missing photo, crying, Facebook posts, reward-based systems, getting hopes up for the phone to ring, and meanwhile they're stuck in a cage somewhere getting ready to be shipped to God knows where to be poked with needles until they die. And for me, there's a lot of emotion going on with that. And you know,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just gonna say, like, when I watch, this is like a silly comparable, but when you watch TV shows like Law and Order, or I watch Chicago PD a lot, and it's obviously it's not real, but this stuff happens, and sometimes you have to let things unfortunately happen to get the bigger picture.
Yeah.
And so I understand, but it's just like, man, it takes, you know, I'm just really happy. I'm grateful that there's people like you that are able to just look at the bigger picture and say, this is disgusting, and this is something that these people should, you know, get everything they deserve. But in your case, you have to build that case in order for that person to be persecuted to the full extent, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I remember that there was my first case. I was, you know, there was no formal training process, right? But there was this PI who was just this genius who was, he was my handler in my first case while I was working for this small animal rights group. And, you know, I'm having to, you know, learn to wear a camera. I'm scared to hell, you know?
How do you,
no idea.
What's your camera setup like? What are you, doing like
well,
a button?
I can't.
Okay. Got it.
Into it, but what I can say was at the time that we had some pretty shoddy gear that was very difficult to conceal, you know, and yeah. that you know, a lot of cases that I'll work, there'll be people that I think like, if I was to get caught, if I was to look at them mean, they'd piss off. But that first case, I was really worried about getting shot and killed. I mean, these guys were
really,
yeah, these guys. So they were committing some pretty serious crimes. It was this massive target. That was selling dogs to research labs. It was the biggest in the business. When the case shut the target down, and when it did, that void was never filled by other targets. It was just, they were a hated industry. They were a hated target. They were involved in, it was federal. It was federal fraud. So I was reporting directly to the U.S. Attorney's Office, and you know, they knew people were onto them, right? And the guys that I was dealing with, you know, they were junkies. They were alcoholics.
They just wanted
one
money.
Of them, yeah, they just wanted money. And, you know, they didn't think a lot. One of them, he was angry with the boss, with the owner, because the owner wouldn't let him go see his sick daughter out of town. And he took it out on him by taking a bunch of dogs and saying, I think these dogs are dangerous, and just shooting them and killing them. And every dog he shot, he thought, that's $250 to $500 out of the owner's pocket, right? And, you know, one worker would carry a 22 pistol and a quick draw holster on his hip. And after I left the case, that guy, Richard Baldridge, he got drunk while on medication and found out his girlfriend was cheating on him. So he kidnapped her at gunpoint and had her drive him to the guy's house and just unloaded on the guy's house. You know, these are the people yeah. I was working with, you know,
sure.
See, I was worried as hell. And
no,
so,
it makes sense.
Makes sense. Yeah.
The type of people, you know, that would do this to animals, that are all of that makes sense. Complete psychopaths. Yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to be psyched up, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to be like, okay, how am I going to do this?
Yeah.
I'm talking to this PI. He's like, I'm like, all right, I'm not going to, he's like, don't take any risks. You got to be patient. This might not happen in a week or two or a month or two. I'm like, okay, I won't take a risk unless I got like the gold ticket shot. And I'll never forget. He said to me, you don't take a risk even then. Right. I don't care if it makes the whole case. You don't take risks. You do this, you know, you're going to be patient. Right. And it was learning that
because
I think the evidence will break the case doesn't mean it necessarily will. And that if I get caught, that evidence is going to disappear. Right.
Yep.
And so, you know, it was just like waiting it out. And, you know, it was, yeah, I mean, targets like that. And like this other facility, you know, with this individual who was doing surgeries, some of the people there, they can be sociopaths, but there's a lot of people who they are otherwise wonderful people, and they will do terrible things to animals. And there's a lot of complicated reasons for that. I remember there's one story we mentioned in the book is in a chapter called Emma, and it said, I go out to this puppy mill that was supplying a store in New York, and the puppy mill was out of Nebraska, and they actually invite you to the kennel. Nobody does that. Nobody, right? And so I thought, wow, this might actually be a good one. And so I show up, and the dogs have they're in like pens, but they have access to the ground, and it's a little more spacious than what you'd normally see. And I thought, okay, I wouldn't put, you know, a pet, you know, for like that, and, you know, for their whole life, but that's a little better. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, can I? And so they had some chihuahuas, and I said, well, can I see your chihuahua puppies? And the husband and wife, the husband invited me, and he goes, sure, they're inside. Every puppy mill, like if you go to a pet store, most pet stores will tell you, oh, the breeder raises the puppies inside. It's always a lie.
Sure.
They have a whelping barn. These people actually raise the puppies indoors. I couldn't believe it. Right. And so I went in, and this guy was extremely nice and very welcoming. And when I go inside, and this footage is online, it's called Wanda's Little Stars, and I'm filming undercover. Mm-hmm. He has he actually had like baby cribs that he used, and he had the whelping mother chihuahuas and the puppies. And one of them, it's a mother, she's there with a puppy, and I look over, and there's another one, and there's two little puppies, and they're just born. And one of them's pink, and healthy looking. And the other one is dark and purple. And so I pick the puppy up and the puppy's cold to the touch. I'm like, oh, this puppy might not make it. He's like, yeah, some of them just die. And I said, well, what are you going to do? And he said, well, she gives him like a sugar syrup. And I've, you know, from my working undercover at puppy mills, I've seen that. That's not the surefire way to save a puppy. Right? So then I look at the mother and her tongue is hanging straight down. And I see she has no lower jaw. And I said, well, what happened to her? He said, oh, I think she got in a fight in a pen and the jaw just kind of deteriorated.
Jeez.
I thought, good Lord. Okay. So I asked him, I said, well, do you have any dogs? Cause I don't want to, you know, feed their coffers. I don't want to buy a puppy or anything. But I said, well, do you have any dogs that maybe aren't breeding? You know, I have I know someone who may just want an adult dog. He said, yeah, we have this dog named Emma. You know, it's like $100. That's it. And she just won't breed. She's three. So she's only 3 years old. They've had her since a puppy and she just won't breed. So I go to look at Emma. And Emma looks like a fat little dog and she's running around. You can see it in the footage. You know, she's running around. She's fine. And then he picks her up. And when he shows her to me, her teeth are in horrible shape. Now, and again, this statement is, I recorded this statement. He has a state inspector. He has a USDA inspector and he has a dentist that comes by. Emma's teeth were so bad that she had to have over 20 of them pulled. An infection had gone from her teeth through her skull to her nasal cavity and it had caused a heart arrhythmia, right? And these were the nicest breeders I've ever met in my life, right? So we get Emma out and then the problems, Emma's fine. She's in a permanent home now. But when I got Emma out, she didn't know what being in a car was, what music was. She was in a pen where if she looked out in one direction, she saw these giant bushes. And then if she looked out in another direction, she went from the outdoor pen to a little indoor box. And so I remember she would attack my hand when I first got her. I had to kind of I spent a couple days at a hotel to get her to learn to not fear me. And, you know, and I had her on a leash, her first time on a leash. And she's wandering around the grass outside the hotel. And she was just like, you know, she kind of, you know, I had to pick her up so she wouldn't get into something. She attacks my hand and I wait till she's calm and I set her back down. And then she was just exhausted at that point. I remember she pooped and she fell down into her own poop. And then she looked over at this yellow sunset. And that's when it occurred to me, that's probably the first sunset Emma had ever seen in her life. You know, and she's rehabilitated in a forever home. But it was one of those lessons that, you know, if it doesn't matter, you know, how nice or how wonderful of a person you are, is that if you're using dogs for money, if your objective is money, corners get cut. And the casualties are dogs like Emma.
Jeez. Yeah, that's hard. It's hard, man. You know, it's just like I get it, you know, I really do. But it's like, so, all right. So now that I understand a little bit about what you do, what in the future? So let's talk about being proactive for dog owners.
Sure.
Because, you know, the thousands of people that listen to this can then go out and disperse their information too. So from here, there's shitty people doing really crappy things, and that's never going to change, right? I think that's something like that.
Yeah.
I've learned over time that there's just going to be people always doing bad things. So let's say, and I also want to talk about, you know, like what you touched base on in the beginning is, because some of my people that listen to this podcast or may listen to this podcast in the future breed dogs and or buy dogs that have been bred because of their certain liability that
right.
they need their dogs to do. I had a conversation with this on the way over from a client. They were asking about, if you want a pet just to have a dog, go to the shelter. But if you need a dog to do a specific thing, like law enforcement doesn't like to lean on mixed breeds because of so many different variables that go into it, such as funding and making sure that the dog can save a person's life or hundreds of people's lives, you know, making sure that their longevity and their health is going to be as good as it possibly can, as far as we can predict. And there's, so I guess my point is there's definitely a time and a place to buy a purebred dog for certain reasons. That's why they're there. But for anybody else that's in the rescue organization or is looking to get just a dog or even so, would you feel safe to say that any dog in a box store, in the mall, or the places that are selling puppies, the chances of them being in good condition is little to none?
Yeah, the chances of them being in good condition, I would say, is virtually zero.
Okay.
I've worked undercover at a pet store, and it was always puppy. I would visit the breeders that were supplying us, and they were all puppy mills. I know HSUS has just done Humane Society of the United States has just done a fantastic job going undercover into a whole lot of Petland pet stores and just found, you know, seeing all the
mm-hmm.
all the puppies that come in, how sick they get, and how people are trying to sell sick puppies to people. That's what I saw when I worked undercover at a pet store. But from the bottom line is that when you have especially even if it's a pet store, you buy a puppy online, the puppy is separated from the mother about 5 to 6 weeks of age. Right. So, you know, that can cause separation anxiety. Sure. They don't learn to not play bite. They can be afraid of other dogs. Their immune system isn't fully developed, and then it's suppressed because then they get on a truck, they go to a broker, they go to a store, and then they go home to you. Now, if you get a dog from a shelter, fully developed immune system. Right. There's a lot of diseases you're not going to have to worry about. You're not going to have to worry about parvo, mm-hmm. a full grown dog. Right. When it's nature versus nurture, it's so humbling doing an interview with you because you're an absolute professional at what you do. My experience has just been, certainly there are certain things about a lot of breeds that, yes, they hold true, such as Australian cattle dogs, man, they're just going to want to hurt everybody and everything. Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've known a lot of Chihuahuas that are just little quiet snuggle bugs,
exactly.
You know, and they're not all yappy dogs. Right.
Right.
And not all pits are mean. Most of them are just are little snuggle bugs. Right.
Right.
When you get a dog from a breeder, you don't for certain know what you're getting,
mm-hmm.
and no matter what you do to try to raise the dog, there's a nature element that nurture is not going to entirely overcome. Whereas if you get a dog from a shelter, you know, especially if the dog's been fostered, you know, if the dog likes other dogs, likes cat, you should. If it's a good rescue, some of them may not know. Right?
Yeah, a lot of them. They just want the dog out of their foster.
Right, and that's not so. There's several great rescues we discuss in the book Rescue Dogs. Now, one of them is the Animal Rescue League of Iowa. And while your point about law enforcement needing dogs, they know what to do with it, you're 100% right. I do have to say that one of the people that we discussed in the book is Mick McAuliffe. He's ex-Australian Special Forces. He's a dog trainer with Animal Rescue League of Iowa. I love Animal Rescue League of Iowa. I've brought him a lot of dogs from puppy mills, and they're just fantastic. And when he was in the Australian Special Forces, they only used rescue dogs. And the reason is, in his words, he said, you know who you're getting, because they didn't want to just have a dog that they bring up, but the personality, there might be a personality issue that maybe they're not quite sure about, or they're trying to ignore, the training can't overcome. Whereas if they get a rescue dog, they know they get this animal that's been through a lot, has come out the other side, and has this personality.
Sure.
Right.
Proofed.
Yeah. And so, you know, I guess what I would say is, obviously I agree with everything you said. What I would urge listeners to do is, if they say, listen, I really do need this breed because I need this personality, this is absolutely what I need, that alone doesn't necessarily mean you have to have a puppy from a breeder. If you go to a breed specific rescue,
right,
you can find a dog or maybe even a puppy, and you can And you may be able to still find the personality.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you're more likely to find the personality you want if you go to a good rescue where they fostered the dog and they know a lot about the dog, than you are if you just get a puppy. Breed specific rescues are common, but with some places you may have to be more patient if there's not one right in your area.
Yeah, for sure, especially with the breeds that are a little bit more not as bred. And the other, because I'm devil's advocate here, and I have three different dogs. I have my older dog, Lola. She's about 17. I adopted her when I was in high school. My family and adopted her when I was in high school when she was at a PetSmart adoption thing. So basically the ASPCA or some sort of organization will show up to a PetSmart or something and try to adopt out their puppies. So they're not in the store. They're brought to the store for the weekend because there's going to be people there.
Absolutely.
We adopted her there. She's probably going to live longer than any of my other dogs will live ever.
Right.
She's been great temperament. She's been the best. And then I have a St. Bernard, where it was one of those things. So that's the point I want to have a conversation with you about in your experience, because I've seen, and then I have a Dutch Shepherd, and I've seen the way that she, I was there when she was conceived. I was there when she, and I've worked in my profession dealing with, a lot of the different interviews and the different, publicity things that I've been involved in as far as like education and making sure people are aware of what is going on in the dog world. Cause that's just my passion. I've also seen some really, really, really good breeders that from start to finish, the dogs are getting the most, the best benefits of care and really isolating each individual puppy, making sure that they are not only well fed, but getting multiple checks, checkup from the vet, getting everything from their temperature to their weight, to their neurological stimulation being cataloged and dialed in to make sure that the dog is progressing properly. And if not, then they need to take it into consideration. So I will say that in my opinion, I've also seen breed specific, breeders out there breeding true dogs for certain things. And them doing a really great job at that. But I would say that the majority of people, especially in my industry where I'm dealing with pet owners, that are they just want a dog. I always encourage people to go to the shelter because those dogs are going to die more than likely if they don't get adopted. And so I think that there's a transparency of there are good breeders that are actually in home and that's the only thing they really do because they produce really nice dogs for whatever they're breeding for. But I also think that there's a lot of so I guess in your opinion, what's the biggest difference between somebody who's breeding dogs well or humanely, I guess would be the word, and then the biggest difference between that and like a puppy mill would be the way that they are kept, the amount that they're breeding, and the care that they're given? Is that
sure? Yeah, this is getting deep into the weeds, and I love this. This is great. So I guess it's that you know, I have to kind of take a step back, make sure that I'm being objective and fair because, you know, everything that I see is cruelty, right? And when I really and the deeper I look into it, even if it looks good on the surface, I find something is bad. But that said, my common sense tells me that I know that what you're saying is true, right? The problem that I have, and shields up, listeners, because I'm not trying to offend you. Bear with me on this.
It's all good.
Is that breeding dogs means that then dogs die at a shelter.
Sure.
Right. And that does, if you got a puppy from a breeder, it doesn't mean you're a bad person.
Right.
I'm sure you're a wonderful person. Good. You know, if you occasionally breed your dog, again, not trying to put you down. But what I am trying to do is I do want us to try to open up our minds just a bit, because when we get into the weeds of this, a good example to use is people will ask me a lot about humanely raised meat. That's great. It's better if it's like cage free, it's free range. That's way better than if it's just a normal factory farm. But the problem is that if everybody tried, I mean, there's still problems with that. I've worked at cage free facilities and seen the same kind of crimes I see at cage facilities, you know. But still, animals having more space is better. But the problem is that if we all did that, we'd be right back to factory farming, right? So if everybody said, well, all of us want the dog that's just bred and is, you know, and there's 100% attention given, everything's great, we're right back to puppy mills because you gotta supply people with all these puppies. Mm-hmm. There is 2 million a year, right? So I would just urge what I would do is I would try to say that there's this way of thinking about everything, but about animals especially, and it's what allows me as an investigator to draw, if I'm looking for certain types of crimes, to know what kinds of crimes will be committed, how they'll be committed, I can just draw a line straight through the hog farms, poultry farms, puppy mills, cat, mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. And it's purpose-driven thinking, and it's that we look at something and we say, that is here for this reason, right? You know, these animals, they're here so that I can fish them out of the sea. And the reason that these chickens are here is so I can eat them. And the reason that these dogs are here is so I can fight them, so I can race them, and to look a certain way. That's why they're here. But the reality is that they're not there for any reason. right? There's no inherent reason that they're there. We created reasons that suit us. And as time has gone by, those reasons have worked against the physical and psychological well-being of those animals. So if we take a step back and we try to just say, well, if, you know, do they exist for their own reasons? And what would they want, right, in general? And, you know, here we are. It's 2020, right? And things are as bad as worse than they've ever been. Mm-hmm. There's an enormous amount of animals being euthanized in shelters. There's an enormous amount of systemic cruelty with the same types of crimes being committed against dogs as we see factory farmed animals, because they're all essentially, you know, factory farmed. So having caused this problem, what can we do in general to try to solve it? And I would say that, you know, trying to really promote rescue and you know, seeing that, you know, it first saying they don't exist for our profit, we have the ability to provide them with protection and love. That would just kind of be like a good you know, base level.
Sure. And I also think too that We have this conversation a lot with, you know, and between me and my trainers and the industry that I work in, I see a lot of different situations. And I would say that there's always going to be those people, no matter what you and I do, like no matter how hard you work and know how many people you bust and how many whatever, there's always going to be people that's like, I don't care if this animal that I'm buying in Walmart, you know, this beef patty that I'm buying in Walmart, this chicken that I'm getting, I don't care. Just give me what I want. Right. And so, and I've, that's never going to stop. That's never going to go away, which is why we're in the cycle that we're in. And that's life. And we have to do the best we can to go after and educate. That's all you can do is say, that's, you know, that's not fine, but here's some light. Just so you know, this is what's happening. And I guess my point is the people who are, cause it becomes such a hard line, because it's like these people are probably never, I mean, we're going to shed light on them. The bigger corporations, you're doing a good job at shutting down big factory stuff, but it's always going to happen. And now we're getting to a point of hopefully maybe states just won't sell dogs and these types of things. But then of course, then where does it, because my worry is like you're saying, is then these types of people are always going to exist, whether or not they get their, how they get their business out may be dictated off of the hard work that you provide. So my thing is, and of course I know that this has probably come up in your thoughts too, is, and this is just me asking questions. I have no, on one way or the other, like if you shut down the distribution of these dogs in these situations, what if they just said, well, we're just going to keep them in our trunks and sell them in the mall parking lot instead? Because there's going to be those people, and I know that you've seen it and I've seen it, and it's not necessarily, it's hard to target market the demographics of the type of people that are doing this, because it's just ignorancy. You show up to a parking lot with your kids, and there's that scumbag that's sitting there that says, hey guys, I got some puppies, you interested? It's the same exact puppy mill that was distributing the puppies to the people inside the mall, but now because they've been shut down and they don't have, and again, I'm huge devil's advocate here. I'm always,
sure. Oh, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
So now they don't have a warm place to stay in. They don't have food, fresh food and water. And now the scumbags that we are talking about that are continuing to trying to make money, it's the same thing as the drug problem we have. And that's why there's so many battles, you know, of all the things that it's like, you know, people want to monitor them. But anyway, my point is if you take away the ability for things to be semi regulated because they're in a mall under some sort of corporate cap,
right,
taking away that opportunity for some sort of humanity, you know what I mean?
Right.
In that process. But then these people are going to find a different way to do it. And it's not going to, and then it's going to go completely black, like under the table. Do you ever worry about that?
Yeah. So I would say yes and no. I would say that yes, I've certainly seen targets do that. When I've seen them do that, they do it to a lesser degree. Not all of them do it. Certainly a lot of them just don't. But you have individuals that they're narcissists and or sociopaths, and they're in,
right.
they're just not going to stop. But what I've seen them continue is that they because they have to go under the radar to a lesser degree. Yeah, and the only reason I'd say that the other side of it is that whenever I see a law pass like California banning the sale of puppies from pet stores, or even like when New York City passed a law years ago saying puppies have to come directly from the breeder, they can't come from a broker. No more of that, right? You have to know exactly where they're coming from. I remember going out to puppies in the Midwest back then, and so many of them were closing shop. You know, I mean, thousands and thousands of puppy mills have shut down when they started passing laws in Pennsylvania and Missouri for better conditions. For example, a law in Pennsylvania that said your dogs have to be on the ground. Now, you can have all the dogs you want, but they have to be on the ground, and you have to clean it every 24 hours. And the puppy millers said, we can't have 500 dogs and do that. And so the response from the state of Pennsylvania was, well, I guess you can't have 500 dogs. I mean, just right. Thousands of puppy mills just went out of business, right? Now where you're right, where you're right is that it started even before dogs. What I have seen a lot of puppy mills where they used to be hog farms or broiler farms, chicken broiler farms, broilers being the kind of chicken that's raised for meat. Mm-hmm. And with that business, it's competitive, it's tough, they weren't getting as much in government subsidy because a lot of that is subsidized, you know, because a lot of animal ags are losing money, and as much as they could make if they went to puppy milling, because in puppy milling you get a higher price per head and you have more head in a smaller amount of space. So I'd go to a lot of puppy mills where they just converted the hog or the chicken barn into a puppy mill, right? And you know, if they have no other way out, they may try to exist below the radar, but again, it's that's rare, because you know, there's a public outcry against it where we will start to get reports if someone is illegally operating after we've busted them. We start to get reports. People will call us and say so-and-so is selling puppies, right? And then law enforcement or the USDA can go back out and someone can try to check up on them. Not to say it doesn't happen. I mean, it absolutely all the time does, but it's not to the level as it was when everybody was licensed and everybody was selling to pet stores. I think that what we need is to really cut through that. You get to this very complicated, deep level where you'd have to first see that when it comes to puppy milling specifically, these are agricultural animals, right? I remember a massive puppy mill I worked at, I would always say to everybody, hey, you know, how long you been at the kennel, or what are we going to do today at the kennel? And one guy called me out on it one day. He said, why do you call this a kennel? I said, what? And it was 800 dogs there. And he said, I said, well, what do you call it? And he goes, it's the farm. Right. Everybody calls it. It's the puppy farm.
Right.
Right. So that mindset was also legally binding on that case. We couldn't get felony convictions on the target for torture because the judge had convinced the jury that these dogs don't have names, they're livestock. So you can only be misdemeanors, right? Yeah. So, if you can try to make a shift for the agricultural community so that they're already subsidized by the government. Especially a lot of animal ag is, right? Especially the dairy industry is losing profits. They're already subsidized by the government. If we can make a shift to help them produce products that are better for the environment, better for animals, or that don't use animals, and that are healthier for people, then they can maintain their dignity. They can maintain their profits, take care of their communities and their families, and then they don't have to worry about just existing below the radar and trying to profit off of a black market, right? Mm-hmm. You talk about changing diet, especially with environmental concerns, you know, people are trying to shift towards eating a whole lot more plant-based foods, right? And we want more affordable variety. For that, well, we got to start shifting all this animal agriculture, including puppy milling, out of the market and start shifting to that. But we got to take care of our farmers, right? We got to find a way that they can have profits and grow what it is that we need them to grow. So I think that's the long-term strategy. The short-term strategy is just passing laws that make it tougher for them to just blatantly operate and do whatever they want to so many dogs.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the real problem at the end of the day is just people producing really crappy dogs. Cause even if they're purebred, like I can't tell you how many German Shepherds and how many oodles of doodles that walk to my facility that, and it doesn't matter if you want to say, okay, realistically, backyard breeding, quote unquote, and people who are breeding for puppy mills are both wrong, but there are a certain degree of people that are going to be breeding certain breeds for their market, for police agencies that are saving thousands of people's lives, that are out there sniffing bombs. Certain breeds need to be able to do those types of things, and the different trainabilities that they have make them more prone to be successful within that field. But I think at the end of the day, the puppy mills need to be exposed that it's happening. And I think that the puppy mills will be shut down faster than anything else, because it's really easy to convince an entire U.S. market to say, these are these dogs and these are how they're being treated. We need to stop it. Because I don't think anybody's really going to be like, nah, it's kind of okay. Where if you look at like the ag industry, where it's a little bit more geared towards cows, chickens, etc., there's going to be way more people not caring about the way that they're treated, which I don't, you know, which obviously is not right, but it's just how it is.
True. Yeah, so absolutely.
So I think at the end of the day, it's like, you know, anyway, I think that you're doing things that not like myself. I love dogs. I don't know if I could get into myself. I would just freak out. I would just start freaking out. And just,
well, like, I don't blame you.
You know, the first dog I saw that's like laying in their own vomit and just about death, I would call it quits. And so it takes a real good human being to do what you're doing. And I, you know, from being a dog lover standpoint, I appreciate the work that you're doing. And I know that we're running out of time here. So we should hop on a call maybe again and go a little bit more in depth. But until then, again, thank you so much for doing what you're doing and sacrificing your own sanity to get in there and look at the bigger picture. And for anybody that's listening to the podcast that wants to know a little bit more about you and where to find you, you can tell them what you have going on. I know you have a book and a website and things like that. You can plug that right now so people know how to get a hold of you.
Yeah, most of the information on the evidence that I collect on my investigations is for the Companion Animal Protection Society. That's CAPS, CAPS-web.org. My book is written with Gene Stone and a ghost author, Nick Bromley. I'm going to out him because he's a great author. The book is called Rescue Dogs. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. I wrote it under apologies for the alias. It's just the way it is due to my work, under the name Pete Paxton. And also, if you're looking for additional information, you can go to hsus.org. They have a lot of information on their undercover investigations of pet stores, and they have a very useful Horrible 100 list of puppy mills. So if you are at a pet store and you are looking at the breeder, if you you can Google it real quick and find it on that list. It's helpful. And I gotta say again, it's so humbling. Thank you so much. So humbling to be interviewed by you, because you're good at what you do. It's a real honor. I appreciate it.
Thanks, man. And like I said, let's try to link up again in the future. I think that there's a lot more we can go over, and listeners would be intrigued with. So you enjoy your day. You keep fighting the good fight, man. And I appreciate your time.
You too. Thank you. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. And wow, what a podcast. I hope to have Pete on again. A lot of information. I know it's disheartening, and some of it is just sucks. But at the same time, like, the more we know, the better things will get. And so I'm really grateful to have Pete on to talk about what he's doing in the dog world and how he's exposing these very horrific industry leaders. And I'm really grateful for him going out there and doing that, because I know that I just don't have the stomach to do it. So anyway, thank you, Pete, for coming on. I appreciate it. Thank you guys for joining me on the podcast. I will talk to you next time. Peace.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Stop in and save big money on your next outdoor lumber project now at Menards. Menards has the largest selection of AC2 pressure-treated lumber and decking, and it's easy to load in our outdoor lumber yard. Plus, you can get free estimates fast with our deck design program in-store or on Menards.com. Check out our weekly flyer for more great deals happening now at Menards.
Save